Chapter 3, Nehemiah chapter 3. It is a funny passage that we've got before us, isn't it? Just to sort of think of where we've got to so far, we've looked at the previous sort of chapters and we kind of summarise it saying, well, when God says pray, you pray. That's what's happening in Nehemiah 1. He lives miles away. There's nothing he can really do physically with his hands apart from pray. And so that's what he did. When God says wait, you wait. That was our sort of second sort of theme. That there's at the beginning of chapter 2 of Nehemiah, there's quite a long wait. There's at least 4, maybe getting on for 5 months, again, while Nehemiah has to wait. And so he waits on the Lord, God directs him and begins to sort of shape the way he's thinking and so on. And then when God says go, you go. So Nehemiah made the journey, that's in chapter 2, verse 9. He makes the journey to Jerusalem, and again, he just quietly sort of investigates the situation that they had there in Jerusalem, and starts sort of planning things over those first few days. And then when God says serve, you grab your shovel. And that's where we are today then, in chapter 3, giving it the title, Grab Your Shovel. Because that's what the whole of this chapter is about. Now, it's quite a long chapter, one of the longest ones we've had so far in Nehemiah. And it is full of, at my guess, 120 Jewish names that, you know, are pretty old-fashioned. You know, we don't know anyone with names like that. So it's describing events that happened 2,500 years ago in a city most of us have never been to, and even if we had, it doesn't look anything like it anymore. What is it that's going on in this chapter? It's also quite an unusual chapter in God's words. There's not many chapters quite like Nehemiah 3 in their descriptions of things. What is the significance of what's happening there in Nehemiah chapter 3? We've been thinking of the story of Nehemiah. Well, let's just pause for a minute and think about the same story from a different perspective. Let's pick someone on the list who's described for us in those verses. What about in verse 8, we have a man called Hananiah the perfumer. That's an interesting job. You know, he was concocting sort of perfumes and ointments and things like that. He may also have been a bit of a sort of a herbalist, or sort of an old-fashioned sort of pharmacy, that kind of idea of using sort of herbal remedies and things like that. Anyway, so that was his job. Think of someone living in Jerusalem, like Hananiah. He's born in exile, probably, lived as a prisoner of war in Persia. And then he's been, you know, practically treated as a slave. And then he's had a chance to return to his home, to Jerusalem. And so when all these people return, we don't know exactly. Maybe they returned years before under Zerubbabel or Ezra, or maybe their parents did, and they could be sort of the next generation living there. Anyway, they journeyed that long trip to Jerusalem back to their homeland. And they returned there to find that it was nothing like the place they left. It was a bomb site. They'd razed it to the ground. The whole thing. This was the third time the Babylonians had attacked Jerusalem. And that was the final straw. And they just demolished the whole place. From top to bottom. Farms were ruined. Homes were ripped down. The temple was demolished. The walls had all collapsed and so on. That's where they were. They returned to a bomb site. As you... some of the older folk can remember seeing places after the Second World War. Just sort of precarious bits of walls and rubble and things like that. Or perhaps you've seen them in photos. That's what it was like. They lived in the aftermath of a war. In a war zone. And so they came back. What were they going to do? People like Hananiah and these other people in the list. Well, they rebuilt a house. Maybe their old house, if they could find what remained of it. They would have worked their trade, like Hananiah the perfumer. Would have made his perfumes, his herbal remedies and things like that. They get on with their DIY, they visit B&Q, they put a roof back on the place, they fix things up. But they still live in a largely derelict city. We've seen places even this week of various parts of Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip and things like that. You know, the whole place has just been demolished. And even if they rebuilt their house, that was kind of what it looked like out the door. A tumbleweed blowing past. It refers in one of the prophecies to wild animals that were living in the ruins of Jerusalem. It was that kind of bleak existence. And there's the question we're sort of coming to. What did God want them to do? What was God's work? What did he want the people to do who are now back in Jerusalem? Well, they rebuild the temple. It takes a couple of attempts and falters somewhat along the way, but in the end they get there and rebuild the temple. So that's up this end of Jerusalem. And they rebuild their homes. Perhaps there's a sort of sense of things going back to normality. They rebuild marketplaces and the shops and things like that so people can trade and come and go and sort of some sense of normality. But not really as well. It is sort of a living, perhaps a bit more like in a refugee camp, where there's sort of this basic existence going on, but it's hardly back to normal, and so on. What did God want them to do? They were God's people. He'd rescued them from Babylon. He'd brought them back to Jerusalem. He'd brought them together as a people of God. And now what? What were they meant to do? Well, they carried on their family life. They got married, had children, and so on. Raised up another generation, so on. That went on for some decades in between Zerubbabel coming back and Ezra and now Nehemiah, and so on. But life was very hard for them. You wonder how much perfume Hananiah was selling, really. That was kind of a sort of a luxury good that most people were not having in this time. They might have traded and so on. The population was quite small. There they are living in Jerusalem. And then along comes Nehemiah. Think of it from the perspective of the people living there. In comes Nehemiah from hundreds of miles away. He's appointed as the new governor from the king. And he comes to Jerusalem, and a couple of days later, he launches out with his big manifesto in chapter 2, with his bubbling enthusiasm and energy, with big plans and ambitions to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. I wonder what the people thought at first when they heard that. They said, what? Who is this guy? What does he know about what life is like here? Is he crazy? Has he seen how much rubble there is? Has he seen how few the people are here in this place? Well, Nehemiah speaks to them, as we got in chapter 2. We looked at it last week. And Nehemiah tries to encourage them to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. We're told in chapter 2, verse 17, you see the distress we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste, the gates are burned with fire. Come, let's rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so that we may no longer be a reproach. I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and the king's words that he had spoken to me. So Nehemiah tries to encourage them. Maybe we're not told. Maybe Nehemiah took them back into the Bible. They do it later on. To think about God's promises and what God had said. Let's just look at a couple in Isaiah to get a flavour of what now, what are they meant to be doing? Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 21. So maybe they sort of dipped into these sort of promises and prophecies of old. Isaiah chapter 1 verse 21. How the faithful city's become a harlot. It was full of justice, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. It talks about how Jerusalem before Babylon came was so rebellious and turned against God. And so God was the one who brought the Babylonians, who ended life as it was in Jerusalem. But then he promised that they would be restored. Isaiah 1 verse 26, I will restore your judges as of the first. Afterwards you will be called the city of righteousness, the faithful city. Zion will be redeemed with justice, and the penitents, the repentant, with righteousness. God promised restoration for Jerusalem. So there, the city, and no doubt Nehemiah, as he tries to inspire people, is thinking about this being the city of promise that God had given them in the past, and God hadn't finished with Jerusalem. And so Isaiah perhaps would have told them, look, God said he would redeem us and restore Jerusalem, and now that's starting to happen. Now they were back in that place. Now things were starting to get sort of slowly step towards normal and so on. What is this city of promise. Look in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house, that's the temple, shall be established on the top of the mountains, and all the nations shall flow to it, and many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord. He will teach us his ways. And the word of the Lord will go out from Jerusalem. It's a city of promise. Why does Jerusalem matter? Isaiah says, maybe Nehemiah told them, look, because this is where the nations will come and learn of God. And God's word is going to go out from Jerusalem to all the different parts of the world. That's why Jerusalem matters. Skipping on to places like Isaiah 40. And in Isaiah chapter 40, God sends a message of comfort to Jerusalem. Comfort my people. Speak comfort to Jerusalem. Tell her that warfare has ended. Again, that might be the kind of message that would inspire the people who'd lived through those same times. Verse 9 of chapter 40, O Zion, you who bring good tidings, get up on the high mountains around Jerusalem and lift up your voice. Do not be afraid. Say to the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord God is coming. Why did Jerusalem matter? Because God was coming to Jerusalem. God himself was going to come to this city. That's why it mattered. Isaiah 59 and verse 20. Pitching in another sort of term for the same sort of thing. The Redeemer will come to Jerusalem. Another promise. A Redeemer was going to come there. And last one, Isaiah 62 and verse 11. Behold, the Lord has promised to the end of the world. Say to the daughters of Jerusalem, salvation is coming. His reward is with him, his work is before him, and they will call them the holy people, the redeemed of the Lord, and you will be called, sought out, a city that is not forsaken. There's just a couple of the promises that we find. The Redeemer's going to come to Jerusalem. Salvation's going to come from Jerusalem. That's why it matters. Maybe it was with words like that, those prophecies of old, that Nehemiah inspired the people of Jerusalem to rebuild the city. Come back to our question, what did God want them to do? Back in exile, back there in Jerusalem, their whole focus now was on getting ready for the Messiah. They live in the very last days of the Old Testament. Nehemiah is probably the last book, as well as Malachi. It's about getting ready for the Messiah who is going to come, they wouldn't know, but in about 400 years' time. That's the kind of timescale for it. And so Jerusalem needs a wall, because it needs to survive those tumultuous centuries that are going to come before Jesus does. It needs to be there, physically, on that mountaintop. Nehemiah's got other plans. We'll come to them later in the book. Plans to repopulate the city. Plans to restore the worship that was going on in the temple. Plans to revitalize God's people, who are very despondent at this time. And here we have chapter 3, which, with all its 120 Jewish names, is quite beautiful, isn't it? Isn't it a beautiful chapter? Because you have God's people who are saved by him, rescued by him, brought together to their home, and they get on with the task that God's given them. It's all about the city of promise. They've got to get things ready because God is going to come to Jerusalem. The Redeemer is going to come. Salvation is going to happen there in Jerusalem. And then the word is going to go out from Jerusalem. It's all there in the prophecies of old. That's where it's going to be. For us, what about for us? What does God want us to do? We're here, Ashbourne in Brailsford. What does God want us to do in the time that he's put us? Well, it doesn't actually have much to do with Jerusalem anymore. Funny how it's been so much in the news over these last few weeks. For the people of Nehemiah's day, Jerusalem was the city of promise, where it all was going to happen. For us Christians, Jerusalem is the city of memories, in some ways, where it did all happen, isn't it? And so in our sense, when we think about building God's kingdom, we're not thinking about a city like Jerusalem, really, and thinking we've all got to go there and build it up and so on. Because in the New Testament, the focus changes, doesn't it? Or it carries on from those promises. That salvation would come to Jerusalem, and then the word would go out from Jerusalem. And that, of course, is what exactly Jesus says, doesn't it? In his own ministry. That the word would go out. The gospel's got to go out into all the world. And so for us, where do we fit? What does God want us to do? Sometimes perhaps there's a tendency to have a similar mentality, perhaps, to the people of Nehemiah's day. To sort of hunker down and think, oh, life's hard. And we might think of the days of old when thousands of people would come and listen to Christians, and hundreds of people were becoming Christians and so on. And we think, oh, it's very hard now. And sort of huddle around our little campfire in the ruins of Jerusalem, in a sense, and think, oh, we're just going to sort of grin and bear it, just try and survive and hang on through these hard times. And perhaps we busy ourselves like the people of Nehemiah's day, and we build our own homes and we get those all nice and fancy, and we concentrate on our jobs and our family life, and perhaps we lose sense of the big picture. And Nehemiah comes to Jerusalem and he shows them that big picture. And for us, in some sense, it's similar. For they were looking in the Old Testament sense of the Messiah coming. We're thinking of the Messiah coming again, aren't we? We still have those promises. It isn't just we're sort of eking out our existence here and life's very difficult and we're just, you know, do the things you want and concentrate on bits and bobs that you know, take your fancy and so on. The Messiah is coming again. Jesus Christ is returning. And don't we want to be, as Christians, those who are involved in building God's kingdom? No longer is it a kingdom of bricks and walls. It's a kingdom of hearts, where Jesus reigns as Saviour and Lord in people's hearts. As we seek for that to grow, we seek that for more people to come to know and love him. And so God's kingdom is built up by the message and power of the gospel. God's kingdom is built by holy living, by courageous witnessing. It's built up by powerful preaching and persistent praying. That's how God's kingdom is built today. We want hearts to be added to the kingdom of God. We want people, men and women and children, God's elect, to be brought in to that growing kingdom. Not a kingdom of walls, which kind of had the idea of protecting and surviving, but actually the gospel has more in mind of bridges, of roads going out, of reaching other people with the message of the gospel. What is God's work? What does he want us to do? Do we get inspired like the people of Nehemiah's day to get involved in God's work? C.T. Studd wrote a poem. It's quite long. I'll just give you a couple of verses of it. He said this: one life, yes, only one. Soon its fleeting hours will be done. Then in that day my Lord to meet and stand before his judgment seat. Only one life, it will soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Only one life, a few brief years, each with his burdens, hopes and fears, each with its days I must fulfill, living for self or living God's will. Only one life, it will soon be past, only what's done for Christ will last. Give me, O Father, a purpose deep, in joy or sorrow thy word to keep. Faithful and true, whate'er this life, pleasing thee through my daily life. Only one life, it will soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Oh, let my love with fervour burn. From the world now let me turn, living for thee and thee alone, bringing you pleasure on your throne. Only one life, it will soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Someone with a similar sort of view to Nehemiah, isn't it? What matters? What matters here? Living for Christ. Seeking to build his kingdom. So there's our first question. What is God's work? Second question then, who can do it? Who can do God's work? Maybe the people living there in Jerusalem heard of Nehemiah's ambitious plans and thought, well, I hope he's a professional. I hope he is a master engineer and has experience in the building trade. Or perhaps they thought to themselves, all right then, Nehemiah, we're going to have a whip round, aren't we? And hire some big team of builders here to get this job done. Did you notice as we read Nehemiah chapter 3, the different occupations of people that were mentioned along the way? In verse 1 and verse 22, you have priests taking off their robes and grabbing a shovel to move the rubble of the wall. In verse 17, you have Levites again leaving their duties in the temple and taking up a wheelbarrow instead. In verse 26, you have the Nephilim, again, their temple servants, who are now setting to work building the wall. In verse 12 and 17 and 16 and others, you have quite a few of those who are mentioned as being rulers of a district of such and such. They were rulers, leaders, more used to sort of chairing meetings and sitting behind in a boardroom with their office work and writing with their pens and pencils. And now they're taking up a trowel and mixing cement instead. Verse 32 has a band of goldsmiths, no longer making intricate jewellery, but lugging bricks instead. Verse 8, we mentioned him already, a perfumer, leaves his careful little chemical concoctions and mixes, and instead there is building and slapping mortar onto those walls. Verse 32 has merchants. Verse 29 has guards and soldiers from the east gate. And in verse 12, you have Shaman's daughters. A bit interesting, they're the only females who are mentioned in the list. How old they are, we don't really know. Many women, of course, in those days would have been involved in very labour-intensive work at home. Cooking and cleaning clothes and so on would have been very laborious tasks. So most women in those days would have been entirely occupied within the home. Whether they leave those things behind, whether they're young, unmarried, because it refers to them as being daughters rather than somebody's wife, but you know what I mean. They're there, getting involved in the task as well. How old these people were, we don't know. Were there jobs for everyone to do of whatever strength they could manage? Or those who were physically able? Maybe it did require some very strong individuals to be shifting rubble and carrying bricks. But were there others? Well, perhaps quite as strong as that, but supplying the others, maybe bring around drinks and so on to keep them going. You know, it was a whole combined effort, wasn't it? Working together, men and women, priests from the sort of upper echelons of society, leaders and rulers of districts, working alongside soldiers and merchants and so on too, and servants, all working together. Who can do God's work? It doesn't matter what sort of background, what sort of occupation you come from. Did you notice, as we look through chapter 3, of the different places that were mentioned? It's all about Jerusalem, but not all the people come from Jerusalem. Did you notice that in the list? There's places like Jericho that are mentioned, Tekoa, Gibeon and Mizpah, Zanoa and Beth Hakkerem, Beth Zur and Keliah. Some of these places we have no idea where they are. Some of them we do. And some of them were 10 miles away, 20 miles away. No car to pop in to quickly commute to Jerusalem and do a day's building. They would have probably moved to Jerusalem for the duration of the project. Even though it was miles away, they demonstrated a selfless thing. They left behind their homes, came to Jerusalem, maybe camping out there in the ruins for the months they were there, building the walls. Who can do God's work? Anyone. Everyone. God calls all of us, doesn't he, to serve him, and in the different ways that he gives, using the different skills that he has given to us. And Nehemiah chapter 3 is this beautiful chapter. And there are those beautiful Nehemiah moments, aren't there, in church life. Growing up in my home church, one of my favourite times of year was Easter. Because in the week after Easter, we held a holiday Bible club for a couple of days. Invite lots of children in from the estates around. Anywhere between 50 and 100 children might come along to it for those 5 mornings of the week. It was a great opportunity to be working together. And that's what really inspired me as a young boy growing up and teenager helping out at it and things like that, was God's people coming together to serve him at this holiday Bible club. You'd have the bank manager who would lead the children singing, a physiotherapist on the piano, a retired gardener who was running the prize stall, a businessman who would give a children's talk, a retired nurse who would be working in the kitchen. All God's people coming together. 3/4 of the people in the church probably would have been there on the ground helping with it. And others behind the scenes praying for the work as well. Quite inspiring times. And there's been moments, haven't there, like that for ourselves in our own church. At our own Boys Brigade camps, you know, even back at the Christmas outreach we did with the trailer and things, when we've gone out leafleting and things like that. Those moments when God's people all come together and unite in a task of serving him and working for his kingdom. So there's our second question, who can do God's work? Last question then, how? How should we do God's work? Well, one part of it is just common sense. That seems to be a big bit in here in Nehemiah. There's the repeated sort of mentions, isn't there, in front of his house. Just common sense. If you live in Jerusalem, you might as well rebuild the bit that's right outside your doorstep rather than walking to the opposite end of Jerusalem to build a bit there. There's sort of a common sense approach in doing the thing that's right in front of you. And sometimes that is, in a nutshell, what the Christian faith and serving the Lord is about. Sometimes it is in doing the job that God's put right in front of you. He's prepared good works in advance for us to do. And sometimes they're right in front of your face. As you get out of your house, there's that bit of wall that needs fixing in Jerusalem. So it can be in our own Christian lives. God gives us quite obvious things, and we need to use our common sense in doing them. There's also a sense in which we organise things. You know, again, the repeated sort of comment through the chapter, next to him, so-and-so built, and then next to him, and after him. You know, it's all sort of carefully sort of thought out. It refers to the sections of the wall. And the idea, Nehemiah doesn't dwell on it, but he's obviously, he seems to be the one behind it, doesn't he? That's sort of planning these things through, dividing up the wall and so on into areas, into sort of appropriate, manageable tasks. So no one's biting off more than they can chew. So it's all sort of easy to work out how things are going. And there's that delegation to it as well. Nehemiah downplays his own role in this, but obviously he's the one coordinating things, isn't he? Perhaps a little bit behind the scenes. Even in other parts, verse 17, it talks about the Levites under Rehum. There's somebody in charge, perhaps delegating tasks to other people, and they're all working together in those different sorts of ways. One thing that comes across most of all, perhaps in the chapter, is their enthusiasm. An enthusiasm for serving God. And there's some who get a sort of special mention. There's Hanan and the inhabitants of Zenoa, they're over that way, I think, on the wall, who repaired 450 metres, the only dimension that's given in the chapter. In verse 20, there's a man called Baruch, and he said he did his stretch zealously. Again, just a little mention there of someone who worked extra hard with zeal in the task. Merimoth, he's mentioned in verse 12, but he comes up again in verse 21 because he's doing an extra bit. He's finished his part of the wall and he sees there's another part that needs a bit of extra help, and so he's volunteering for extra duty. Same as Meshulam and the Tekoites, who do a double duty as well. That's one thing there in the chapter, people's enthusiasm for serving God. Nehemiah summarises it in chapter 4 and verse 6. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half the height, for the people worked with all their hearts. It's beautiful, isn't it? They worked with passion and enthusiasm for God's kingdom. We also notice their dedication. They're committed to it. But another sense of using the word dedication, it's committed to God. It's offered to him. A little bit like we were looking in the story of C.T. Studd, and those words, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. And that word comes up in the beginning. The priests start, and they start at this end, near the temple. They start with the sheep gate, which is the gate the sheep come in through to get to the temple for sacrifices. They start there at God's house first. They rebuild the sheep gate and consecrate it. There's a sense in which they give it to God. Say, God, this task, we're just starting, and we're going to try and rebuild these walls. We're doing it for you, not for us. And they give it to God, committing it to him, wanting it to be something that God is pleased with, and so on. And so they commit themselves and the work to God. And those are all good lessons for us to learn, aren't they? Even though we live 2,500 years on, those same lessons we can learn as well. And there's one sad note in the chapter. Do you notice it? In verse 5. Next to them, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. One tiny little sad note. There's the people of Tekoa who come to Jerusalem from another place, and they're there building on the walls, but not their nobles. Not their rulers, perhaps their upper class, perhaps the posher people of Tekoa. Says they wouldn't put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. And the idea is the idea of carrying stuff. They wouldn't stoop down and take the bricks on their back. They wouldn't stoop down and lift the wheelbarrow. No. They don't stoop. No. They're not going to humble themselves to work. Sad, isn't it? Of all these people who go down recorded in the Bible, at least 40 individuals, 12 different places, you know, all these different things, there's one group who get a mention because they were too proud, too stubborn to serve God. But it's only one. Only one sad note. And the chapter is overwhelmingly positive, isn't it? And thinking about these people who are faithful to the task that God gave them in their day and age. And although it's a hard chapter, you can read it again yourselves, I hope you find it a great chapter to look at. And the names are hard to read, but there's a reality in that, isn't there? Because these are real people. Real people with hard to pronounce names. From a different culture to ours, but they're people. And so they give you their list of their person and his father and sometimes his grandfather because they're an individual. And sometimes that's, you know, the name comes up. You know, so the Hananiah we had in verse 8, he's different to the Hananiah in verse 30 because they got different fathers. You know, they're different people. And that's why all the names are mentioned quite so laboriously. Because they're not forgotten. And that reminds us, doesn't it, of Jesus' own words in the New Testament. He says, in that parable, of that reception that people will get from God. And God will say, well done, good and faithful servant. Is that our desire? Is that our desire? To serve God faithfully through our lives and in the situation that God has given us. In Revelation chapter 14, verse 13, it says, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord, for their works follow them. They're remembered. Their names are important to God. These names are written in the Bible. Their names are written in God's book of the Lamb's book of life. And their faithful service, their works follow. It matters. It's important to God. And so it should be important to us. As we've been thinking, what does God want us to do? Who can do it? Any one of us following the Lord. And how should we do it? Well, with these same things of common sense and organisation and the like, but with enthusiasm and passion and dedication and faithfulness. So, as we think of the city of Jerusalem, and all the different names that I've jotted along the walls. Where's your bit? Where's your bit of wall? What's your part in God's work? Serving God. C.T. Studd, we've been looking at it, joy is found in living for Jesus, in serving him. One life, yes, only one. Soon its fleeting hours will be done. Then in that day, my Lord to meet and stand before his judgment seat. Only one life, it will soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. Nehemiah and C.T. Studd can inspire us to serve God more.